Welcome to the first episode of Targeted Talks, a podcast from Targeted Oncology. I'm your host, Nicole Tucker. In this episode, for a discussion on the use of immunotherapy in patients with lung cancer, whether treated in an academic or community setting, and how this could be challenged with the discovery of genetic driver alteration, our guests were Dr. Jason Williams and Dr. George Simon. Dr. Williams of Williams Cancer Institute in Atlanta, Georgia, is a radiologist who specializes in interventional oncology. He is also a researcher with Case Western Reserve University. Dr. George Simon is a medical oncologist who specializes in thoracic malignancies and a professor of medicine at the University of Texas MD Anderson Cancer Center. Dr. Williams begins the talk.
So nowadays, I think the community oncologists have no option but to be involved with immunotherapy. You know, it's really, particularly in non-small cell lung cancer, pretty much every treatment option at some point is going to involve immunotherapy. Initially, the oncologists were somewhat resistant, and it was really a very paradigm shift of how cancer was treated. But now I think everybody's kind of adapting well. There's, been plenty of studies. And of course, we get just recent FDA approval from the CheckMate 227 study with combination nivolumab and ipilimumab. Almost all the oncologists are on board getting on some of the testing associated with it. Previously, in the community, patients, when they get a biopsy, have surgery, we would always have to request for PD-L1 or now more recently tumor mutational burden, mismatch repair, whereas now it's automatic.
That's before, great.
Every patient you had to ask. You would get the pathology results and then you have to ask. Of course, they could get it to you quickly, but I think one of the things discussing on the pros and cons, of course, there's really no option but for patients in the community to be treated, non-small cell lung cancer be treated with immunotherapy because, except for patients who have a driver mutation that get, a targeted therapy, even those patients are ultimately going to probably get immunotherapy as well. So there's not too many situations where you would run into, particularly in an advanced patient, that you're not going to be involved with immunotherapy at some level. And of course, then one of the nice things now is that, the testing as far as like Foundation One, Guardant 360, the next gen sequencing, that's becoming commonplace. One thing is that we still don't have a lot of things that we can act on at this moment. I think a lot of this is still gathering data. I mean, it's just like with the EGFR mutation. I mean, it took quite a while to be able to identify, submutations and to get like the 790 mutation and things like that to develop new drugs to target those. And I think with immunotherapy, we're in the same situation where we've got a lot of data that hopefully we can figure out more and more what to do with it.
I think firstly, I think certain democratization of technology. I mean, the reason why I use that phrase is that in earlier times, many of the academic centers used to do the molecular diagnostics in-house, and many of the community hospitals and clinics didn't have access to those, and generally the patients had to come to those centers and get analyzed. Because of the third-party agencies doing these tests like Foundation One, Caris Diagnostics, Tempus, and a few others, anybody can order it, right. So just anybody, anywhere has the access to the technology as a larger academic center. So that is a fantastic development, in my opinion. The only thing then that really separates the community practice from a large academic center is the availability of information. If the oncologist, remains and stays informed, right? Because he's got all the tools, the same nivolumab is being given in the community center and in academic center. Pembrolizumab is being given in the same company makes it. We buy it from the same source, community site. But so the sources are the same. The drugs are all easily available in many of the centers. And now the testing is also available. right?
Sure.
So there's a democratization of drugs, there's a democratization of technology, and what we need to do is a democratization of information. The easier and more available we make that information is going to be ultimately helpful to patients, because the last time I saw the data, about 85% of the patients are being treated in community practices. You know, most patients don't have the luxury to drive to a nearby center. So that's where, you know, tools that democratizes information. To go back to your point, sometimes we find these rare mutations, right? We do extensive profiling and we find a NFE2L2, we find an FGFR3, or we find a CTNNB1, you know? So what do you do with those? That's where I think an academic center can sort of add value to the community. There we may have drugs, you know, glutaminase inhibitors that may have some activity in NFE2L2 mutations, and other drugs, FGFR inhibitors that are being in clinical trials, you know.
Yeah, and thankfully that's one of the nice things with like the testing with the next gen sequencing is, one thing, it gives you sort of an unbiased big panel instead of doing, you know, sequential sequencing where you have to say, I want to find out about this gene, or I want to find out about that one. And the other thing is the reporting a lot of times actually directs you in the location. So, oh, okay, there's a clinical trial on this, or you could consider this, and so it makes it a lot easier. So it does level the playing field to where people out in the community can get access to things that, you know, just a few years ago they were missing out on. So it's nice to see that. One of the things, of course, that's coming up a lot now is liquid biopsies. Mm-hmm. Obviously, there's huge advantages because, you know, getting tissue samples, repeat biopsies, a lot of times the sample's insufficient, you send it off and it comes back. And so now we got liquid biopsies. However, the one thing that's a little bit unsure with it is that when you see some of the studies, you've got like Guardant 360, and then you've got Foundation One Liquid, mm-hmm. and you will see two different results from the same specimen, but they don't quite match, and they don't match what you get from the tissue. So then that really just makes you wonder.
Right. You know, so liquid biopsies is a great tool. And one of the problems we have right now is we may not have enough tissue. Getting enough tissue is paramount, right? It falls on us oncologists to educate our colleagues, particularly pulmonologists and interventional radiologists and even surgeons who do the first biopsies, to make sure that they actually get a good chunk. Because it's not just the days of just calling it small cell versus non-small cell are gone. Right. We now need to get a deep understanding. So I think the oncologists have a sort of a responsibility in their own communities to make sure that their colleagues, primary care physicians or interventional radiologists or pulmonologists, are educated as to making sure that they get plenty of tissue. You know, and even then, sometimes getting enough tissue is challenging, you know, and so liquid biopsies is a great tool. But when you do liquid biopsies, I think it's important to remember a few rules, you know. The first rule is if it is there, it is there.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's rare for them to have a false positive, you know, and because these are ultimately, at the end of the day, sequencing and next-gen sequencing platforms, and they're very accurate. But the second rule also is important. If it is not there, it could still be there, right? Mm-hmm. So if you don't pick it up on a liquid biopsy, and if you have a high, the patient is a never smoker, and, you know, if a high suspicion that this patient is likely to have an actionable mutation, and the consequences of missing an actionable mutation is pretty severe, right? I mean, you give a pill, if you mix an EGFR mutation, you know, this is a disease you could have controlled with the pill for 4 years, 5 years, at least median is 3.5 years, right? And before you even have to pull out chemotherapy or immunotherapy or anything like that. So since the consequences of missing an actionable mutation are fairly severe, so if the liquid biopsy says it is not there, you still have to look at the tissue.
Yeah.
Okay. And that's an important point to understand. I have run into situations where a liquid biopsy was negative and they called it a day there. Even if you don't have tissue and you ran the liquid biopsy because you didn't have tissue, you know, and if the liquid biopsy comes back negative, it just falls on us to redo the biopsy. Now, to go back to your point about why some platforms pick up some things and why platforms don't pick up some things. It's really the details of the actual testing. If you look for a lot of genes, you have a lower depth of detection of each gene. What I mean by that is if you're looking for 100 genes, you may be able to detect only one in 100 copy, you know, if there's one copy in 100. But if you look at five genes, you may be able to pick up that one copy in 1,000 cells, right? So that's what I call the depth. So there's a breadth and a depth. And one comes at the cost of the other. So the more you expand your panel, you give up in sensitivities. Now, of course, you know, the technologies are getting better and better. You know, and I think our crunching power, bioinformatics power is also getting better. So I think, you know, we are now, even with the broader panels, getting down to fairly low allelic frequencies of detection. There are some technical and technological issues, which I think will get better with time. And ultimately, I'm hoping that the need for tissue biopsies will just go away.
Yeah, and I think, you know, obviously with the information, I mean, pretty much if there's a driver mutation and you know, potential targeted therapy, then that's, you know, that's first line for that patient and still ends up being the minority of patients. And most patients are going to go on and get, you know, combination immunotherapy with or without, you know, doublet chemotherapy. We get involved with some stuff with some testing, like particular immune testing. So there's a company, HalioDx, that's France, and they're the ones that do ImmunoScore, which is more for colorectal cancer. Mm-hmm. But they have a test that's called Immunogram, which is really interesting. It's a mix of, it's basically immunohistochemistry plus RNA plus DNA. And so we're really looking at things like that for figuring out the future on you know, different immunotherapy agents. But one of the things that you run into on standard testing as far as like next gen sequencing is you'll get patients where they'll have like an MDMN2 mutation, which in the literature is somewhat associated with hyperprogression. And so then it kind of leaves you to wonder, okay, is this a patient that you shouldn't treat with immunotherapy or do you take your chances?
Yeah, you know, so there are these mutations, P53, RB, KRAS, you know, for which KRAS now we have a targeted therapies which are under development. So a couple of them for G12C, but you know, MDM2 is actually downstream of P53, and MDM2 activation could mean that even if the P53 is intact, the downstream signaling of P53 is compromised. Yeah. So it is not a targetable mutation, but it does, you know, it does, I think, you know, because where I'm, you know, where I work, that information is, I like to know.
Sure.
So I may not do anything about it, right? And later on, you know, some young fellow will come by and look at MDM2 expression and correlate that with survival after immunotherapy treatments. And, you know, we may learn something.
Sure.
You know? So it's a good research tool to have a broad panel. And we may learn things down the road by retrospective analysis and then you know, by prospective validation. So... in that setting, you know, these broader panels are useful. And you know, the other point I wanted to make is that you know, it's not just a minority of patients anymore that may have actionable targets. If you look at the ever increasing list of targets, you know, starting with EGFR and ALK and RET and ROS and NTRK1/2/3 and RET and MET exon 14 skipping and FGFR1/2/3, you know, now we can actually pick up a actionable target in a fairly significant sizable minority is the way I would put it, you know.
Yeah.
30-40%, you may be able to find a target. Now, many of those, you may not use the targeted therapy as first line, you know. Now, for instance, I tend to use targeted therapy as first line for ALK, EGFR, and ROS, right? Those drugs, you know. But if it's a MET exon 14 skipping, you know, now we just saw a new New England Journal paper come out with tipotinib, and just recently capmatinib got approved for MET exon 14 skipping. You know, so there, nobody would really fault you for using chemo or chemoimmunotherapy first, you know, and then you could use some of these because in some of these other targeted therapies, you don't see response rates of 80%. You see more response rates, more like 50%, you know, or less. And then the duration of response, like in EGFR therapies, is not 19 months as an osimertinib for EGFR, but maybe more like 6-7 months, you know. So, but it's, again, useful to know. And then, you know, so those targeted therapies may not be as effective as the EGFR ALK-ROS setting. But then it's a good, you know, research question we can ask. Can we make it more effective? Is there any way we can, should we combine chemo with these targeted agents, for example, or anti-angiogenesis agent with this targeted therapy? So those kind of, and I'm just throwing some examples out there. I'm not suggesting that you should do those studies, but, you know, so there are more questions to be asked, more research to be done, you know, more things to be learned in that setting. So I think having a broader panel, even though many of those actionable mutations, many of the mutations may not be imminently actionable, can really, really add value, in my opinion, for future patients.
Yeah.
And future oncologists, you know, to sort of learn and understand these tumors and how they behave.
Right. Yeah, I agree. That's, we need the data for a while to figure out what to do with it.
Right.
Well, you know, obviously, you know, now immunotherapy really, you know, is, well, it's everywhere. And, you know, of course, the one of the things I saw was that initially the oncologists were hesitant when it was first becoming approved from 2011, 2014. Of course, then you had like Jimmy Carter,
right.
Melanoma, created a huge interest where then basically every patient comes and asks for it. Also, of course, you know, one of the things that you see is that even though in the whole scheme of things, the response rates are not as good as we'd like to see, but they're not bad. But you get, you know, at least a percentage of patients who have these long-term responses, may go on to be cured. And there's enough of them talking to everybody else that creates the huge interest. But really, yes, we know now that all, you know, with all, it's we have a lot more options. I mean, you know, you can get by with basically no PD-L1 expression. If you need to, or if you've got a lot of different options. And yeah, I wanted to ask, what do you think on the timing and sequencing of the immunotherapy agents? I mean, if you have a patient comes in, they have no driver mutation, you know, they're a non-squamous, non-small cell lung cancer. Would you at that point go with Pembro? Oh, well, let's say they have increased PD-L1 expression. Would you have Pembro alone, or would you go Pembro with chemo, you know, together?
Yeah, that's a great question. We are doing some work to try to tease that out. You know, so let's take the situation where you have no drivers, and you have PD-L1 more than 50%. And in that setting, you know, should you use single agent or should you use the triplet, right? The truthful answer is we actually don't know.
Yeah.
We don't. Okay. However, you know, one of the things one of the things that I do, and again, this is, you know, just me, is that if you look at the squame studies, if you look at the studies with, so I divide that into squames and non-squames.
Sure.
In the squamous trials, if you look at the single arm study, just the single agent trial, which is called KEYNOTE-407, which is the triplet carbo-taxol pembrolizumab versus carbo-taxol. And then if you look at the more than 50% subset in that group, you know, then in that setting, and then compare it with KEYNOTE-24 or KEYNOTE-41, what I found was that the hazard ratios for the triplet versus the single agent pembro, if you were a squamous, were actually pretty close. Mm-hmm. Okay. So what I tend to do, this is just me, what I tend to do is if it is a squamous, the PD-L1 is more than 50%, I more often than not just go with the single agent.
Sure. Yeah. Okay.
And if it is a non-squamous, and the hazard ratio seems to be better for the triplet, even if it is PD-L1 more than 50%. And so if the patient is younger and if the patient has a good performance status, okay, in that setting, I might actually go with the triplet, even if the PD-L1 is more than 50%, yeah. You know. I've run into situations where the PD-L1 is through the roof, 90%, 100%. There, I almost always go with a single agent, you know. But if it is, you know, 60 or just barely making it above 50, you know, even if it is 70, I tend to go more with the triplet because the hazard ratios for KEYNOTE-189 for the triplet, which is the study that looked at carbo-pem-pembro versus carbo-pem, the hazard ratios seem to be, now again, we shouldn't be comparing KEYNOTE-24 versus KEYNOTE-42 versus KEYNOTE-189. You know, we shouldn't compare across the studies. But when we are faced with a decision like this, when should we use a triplet, should we use, you know, you have to work with the available information. You know, we are oncologists in the trenches, you know, and the patients look up to us for answers, right? So we have to give them answers based on the information we have currently, you know. And so therefore, that's why we look at the, you know, the performance status, the age, the comorbidities, you know, look at all that. And then on top of that, look at the hazard ratios for these studies and then make a decision. So sometimes even if it's more than 50%, if the patient is young and the PD-L1 is barely above 50 or, you know, and the patient's otherwise healthy, I may just go with the triplet. But if the patient is, say, older, you know, 78, 80, I might just go with the single agent, even if the PD-L1 is 60. If the patient is younger, but the PD-L1 is 100% or 90%, then I may just go with the single agent, you know. So I think a lot of things are taken into consideration when you make those decisions. I think in the squamous setting, it's a little bit easier. I just tend to go with the single agent if it's more than 50%. But in the non-squamous setting, I think a lot of things come into play.
Well, one of the things also is kind of beyond the traditional immune checkpoint inhibitors is, you know, other combinations or novel combinations. And we see a lot of discussion of very interesting things. I mean, first thing you see a lot of patients doing various things on their own that could be, well, I mean, is, you know, a lot of unusual things. I know you guys see it at MD Anderson. And, you know, interesting. One of the drug combinations that we see a lot are basically drugs that function as hedgehog pathway inhibitors, which of course there's some interesting studies, you know, indicating that the effect of tumor associated macrophages, which we know might be a major suppressor. So it's not surprising in some form that you'll see patients doing something like that, and you see kind of a very, very interesting responses. And the other is, of course, you know, you see patients on combinations with, you know, immunotherapy combinations with EGFR receptor inhibitors or other drugs. Now, typically the side effects really go up. From what I recall, there's a study with an ALK inhibitor that was actually worse than either one alone. So I know some of the combinations, theoretically, they might seem good and sometimes they don't work out. But And then you've got other things where there's like the use of losartan to decrease TGF-beta. Lots of off-label drugs, dipyridamole, which of course has had previous, you know, studies with melanoma. What are your thoughts on like some other interesting combinations? Maybe it's, you know, combination immunotherapy with targeted agents, or maybe it's completely off-label drugs.
Yeah. And you bring up a point that is really the the thing that we're trying to learn right now. That's all those things that you just said are under active research investigation right now. You know, there are some, you know, I mean, based on the things that I've seen, there are some broad rules that I would say, you know, it's generally there are always exceptions to every rules, but generally speaking, it is not a good idea to combine a tyrosine kinase inhibitor with an immunotherapeutic agent, you know. And then generally speaking, I think very, very carefully before I give immunotherapy to non-smokers and never smokers. I've just seen worse outcomes, more pneumonitis, you know. And you're exactly right. Combination studies with gefitinib and immunotherapeutic drugs have all been abandoned because of fair bit of toxicities, including pneumonitis. You know, both the TKI and the immunotherapeutic drugs can cause. So generally speaking, in an actionable driver mutation setting where we have a good targeted therapy, the targeted therapy alone, when I say alone, combined with immunotherapy, you know, target therapy alone is better. Now you could combine the targeted therapy with an angiogenesis inhibitor, which is there with chemotherapy in some settings. Those are different. I'm just talking about the combination between the TKI and the immunotherapy. You know, it's generally I think it's not a good idea and should only be done in the setting of a protocol or a clinical trial. Now, I think at least in the lung cancer setting, you know, I think the chemotherapy plus immunotherapy combinations are actually doing reasonably well. You know, we have obviously a slew of data in the stage four setting, but we have also now getting data in the neoadjuvant setting. And generally those studies are showing that it's actually, we're getting great responses if we give chemotherapy plus immunotherapy. You know, immunotherapy by itself can sometimes, in the neoadjuvant setting, can have its problems, you know.
Sure.
Now, combination therapies are the way to go, you know. One of the quirks about immunotherapy is that the response rates, like you pointed out, it's not very high. You know, one of the things I tell fellows is, you know, if somebody asks you, what's the response rate of atezolizumab in kidney cancer? 15%. Mm-hmm. Even if you don't know it, okay? Because
right.
The odds are you'll be right. You know, you throw immunotherapy almost in any tumor, you get a 15% response rate.
Yep.
You know, give or take a few percent, you know, 12%, 15%, 18%. They're somewhere in that ballpark, you know. You know, and you wouldn't be very wrong. I mean, you wouldn't be totally off base. You know, you would be somewhere in the ballpark. But that being said, the fundamental difference between immunotherapy and, say, chemotherapy is actually the duration of response. You know, I tell my patients, if you take immunotherapy and you respond, you know, unlike chemotherapy where the progression-free survival is 4 to 6 months, you know, in the first line setting, you know, or second line setting, you know, almost 89% of the patients who respond to immunotherapy would still be on immunotherapy for a year.
Right.
And that goes back to, you know, President Carter. You know, he's been on that immunotherapy combinations for
5 years. Yeah.
5 years now.
Yes.
Right. So that is the duration of response is the exciting part. You know, if you are a responder, then you tend to have very durable, long responses, which is very, very attractive. You know?
Sure.
Now, to further augment the benefit of immunotherapies, people are exploring combinations, and the combinations, you know, people can be classified in multiple categories. You know, combining it with cytokines, you know. IL-2 like drugs, IL-15, interleukins, and then people are now looking at combining it with cellular therapies, PD-L1 plus a sort of, there have been studies with sort of the off-the-shelf T-cell, you know, CAR T-cells or T-cell receptor modified T-cells, or there's a slew of, you know, those have been combined. You know, and other sort of, you know, modifying agents. People are looking at, epigenetic agents in combination. So there are a lot of, there are a variety of compounds that are being investigated in combination with immunotherapy. And I think those are all attractive studies. You know, of course, you have to have a preclinical rationale, and we should have some understanding of what's the mechanism and how do we think that that other agent augments the efficacy of immunotherapy without adding too much toxicity. You know, so if you go to clinicaltrials.gov, you'll see a variety of studies combining a variety of classes of agents with immunotherapy.
Yeah, there's of course there's a lot of interesting work that I see with, you know, various drugs that like normally, well, and these are mostly, we're not necessarily talking about lung cancer, but you know, combinations with like PARP inhibitors, but for patients that aren't, that don't carry the BRCA gene or things that, like that, that the target, the agent that you're using, you really don't have a target to match that, but you use it with immunotherapy and then they get synergy. Mm-hmm. That's why I do think the hedgehog pathway one is a very, very interesting. And another one that just, I just saw an article and was very interesting. This was actually, was a study they were looking at medulloblastoma, mm-hmm. but so medulloblastoma has a lot of, you know, P53 mutations.
Correct.
And the P53 mutation, one of the things that they were saying was that it leads to a lack of expression of MHC1, mm-hmm. Which I've seen some of that, but of course also it's associated with like P10 as well. Mm-hmm. But the thing that they found was that if they injected a tumor necrosis factor, mm-hmm. or they administered it as systemic, that it ended up the tumors that had P53 mutations began expressing MHC at like almost 100%, and then PD-1 inhibitors were actually effective. And this kind of, yeah, there's a lot of the ideas of what things you can do to make immunotherapy not work, because, you know, obviously one of the big issues is that you've got immunologically cold tumors.
Right.
And so amongst other things, I mean, there's a lot of reasons why and, you know, various aspects, but if you can convert an immunologically cold tumor to hot, then you're more likely to respond to typical immune checkpoint inhibitors. One at SITC that a couple years ago that was really interesting was that they found that patients who had lung cancer who got the flu while they were getting immunotherapy had an increased response rate. So then, of course, they began studying the flu. They started injecting in animals. They were injecting live flu, which didn't really work, but dead flu worked, which turns out to be the flu vaccine. And they actually did a few human patients and got good results in that. So it's a, you know, interesting concept of things that you can inject. I know Orléans Mabel, who's in Paris, has done a lot of work with the rotavirus vaccine, mm-hmm. injecting as a RIG1 agonist. And so there's a lot of like simple things that we could do that's inexpensive that might could take our success level up, at least a few notches.
So those combination studies, you know, one of them is we talked about with cytokines, you know, but people are exploring a variety of strategies.
And I think we've discussed a lot of the, well, you know, biomarkers, novel targets, I don't know, and the genetic drivers. I mean, in relation to immunotherapy, I mean, still it's basically if there's a genetic driver, then it's going to be targeted therapy, and if not, then immunotherapy is going to be first line with or without chemo. One of the things would be, I guess, sort of, you know, let's say you have a patient, you know, let's say they failed, you know, let's say you've gone through a couple lines, you've done, you know, immunotherapy. I mean, maybe they did a target agent, maybe they did immunotherapy, and they failed. From my standpoint, that's where we would really start considering combination, like ipilimumab with nivolumab or pembro or some combination such as that, with or without chemo. I just want to get some of your thoughts on that.
Yeah, the short answer is we don't know, but we need to study it. Okay, so what are the response rate? And we are actually looking at a retrospective data set to understand that question and then try to answer that question. If you give a PD-1 inhibitor first line, and then you bring in a PD-L1 inhibitor after that, what can you expect? Or do we still see a few responses? Or let's say we use a PD-L1 inhibitor first line, and then we use a combination of ipi-nivo second line, you know, a PD-1 inhibitor plus a CTLA-4 inhibitor. Do we see any responses? You know, so it's a different form of immunotherapy after an immunotherapy challenge. You know, do we see any responses? The fact of the matter is, we may not actually see a clinical trial in that regard, because most of the clinical trials have used immunotherapy in the first line setting. And those are the questions that sometimes maybe have to be answered by what I call real world data. And our center has developed such a database where we track all the patients who are not on clinical studies. You know, the clinical studies are already being tracked in that data set, right? But those who are not going on clinical study, they sign a consent form and they go on a database, you know, and we track them longitudinally. Having that data available in a database will help us answer some of these questions. Yeah. So I've become a proponent of using real-world data and using big data and using our crunching tools, you know, whether it is cognitive computing or AI, or call it what you will, is to use these tools to help us answer some of those finer questions. And hopefully in the future, one day, we may be able to put all the information into a computer system and say, what would be the best treatment for this patient?
Yeah, I agree. I think that it's going to really transform things. And yeah, hopefully we can get to a point where, you know, the computer will analyze, look at all the genes, everything else, and it'll say exactly what you need to do.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Targeted Talks. Tune in next month for another episode.